Martin Amis's The Zone of Interest has become a cultural touchstone for its unflinching examination of human nature's darkest corners. Recently adapted into an Academy Award-winning film, this novel forces readers to confront uncomfortable truths about complicity and moral corruption. Celebrities from Ralph Fiennes to Natalie Portman have cited it as a transformative reading experience, with Fiennes noting that it reveals the mundane mechanics of evil in ways that change how you view human capability. Literary critics have placed it among the most important Holocaust novels ever written, not for its depiction of suffering, but for its chilling portrayal of the perpetrators' inner lives, their desires, jealousies, and bureaucratic concerns that continue alongside genocide. The Zone of Interest unfolds in Auschwitz, referred to as KZ by characters, specifically focusing on the administrative area where Nazi officers and their families lived in relative comfort just yards away from the death camp. The novel's brilliance lies in this juxtaposition, domestic life continuing in the shadow of industrial murder. Amis employs a rotating first-person narrative structure through three distinct voices. Golo Thompson, the nephew of Martin Bormann and an IG Farben representative overseeing the Buna Verke synthetic rubber factory, Paul Dahl, the camp commandant, and Shmuel Zachariash, a Jewish prisoner forced to work in the Sonderkommando, the special unit that processed corpses. This tripartite structure creates a kaleidoscopic view of the camp, each perspective revealing different aspects of the moral catastrophe. The physical layout of the camp becomes a metaphor for the compartmentalization that enables atrocity. Officers' villas with manicured gardens sit adjacent to crematoria. The Buna Verke factory represents the unholy alliance between industry and genocide. The Zone of Interest itself, a term used by Nazis to describe the area surrounding the camp, becomes a liminal space where normal human boundaries collapse. What's particularly striking is how Amis captures the sensory reality of Auschwitz. The smell of burning bodies permeates everything, requiring characters to smoke cigarettes constantly to mask it. The sound of screams is dismissed as people pretending it's Walpurgis night. These sensory intrusions represent the truth that cannot be fully suppressed despite elaborate psychological defenses. At the heart of this novel is a disturbing love story between Golo Thompson and Hannah Dahl, the commandant's wife. Their attraction unfolds against the backdrop of mass murder, raising profound questions about how romantic desire can exist alongside moral catastrophe. Thompson becomes obsessed with Hannah from the first moment he sees her in the garden, comparing his desire to an elephant in must, a state of intoxicated heat. This animal imagery underscores the primal nature of desire that continues even in the most unnatural circumstances. Their courtship proceeds through clandestine meetings and secret notes, taking on the quality of a conventional romance novel, which creates a disturbing cognitive dissonance for the reader. Hannah is portrayed as complex and ambiguous. While married to the camp commandant, she harbors contempt for him and the Nazi regime. Her past relationship with Dieter Kruber, a communist professor who was arrested and killed, haunts the narrative. Is her attraction to Thompson genuine, or is she using him as part of a larger plan to undermine her husband? The novel refuses easy answers. What makes this romance so unsettling is not just its setting, but how it reveals character. Thompson's desire for Hannah exists alongside his complicity in the camp's operations. He may privately disapprove of Nazi excesses, but he continues to facilitate the Buna Verke project that exploits prisoner labor. Hannah's resistance to the regime is real, but so is her continued participation in the social life of the camp's administration. Their love doesn't transcend the horror, it's entangled with it. Perhaps the most chilling voice in the novel belongs to Paul Dahl, the camp commandant, whose sections reveal the administrative mindset that enabled the Holocaust. Dahl embodies what Hannah Arendt famously called the banality of evil. the reduction of genocide to logistical problems requiring technical solutions. Dahl's narrative is riddled with euphemisms and bureaucratic language. He speaks of special train 105 rather than trainload to victims. He worries about disposal methods and fuel efficiency when burning bodies. His sections are filled with technical concerns, how to make naked bodies burn efficiently, and using liquefied human fat to aid combustion, resulting in gasoline savings. This language serves to distance him from the moral implications of his actions. What makes Dahl particularly disturbing is his insistence on normality. He repeatedly describes himself as a normal man with normal needs, revealing a profound self-deception. His sexual frustration with Hannah occupies as much mental space as his genocidal duties. He maintains the fiction that he's simply following orders from Berlin, absolving himself of personal responsibility. Dahl's psychological disintegration forms a crucial narrative arc. As the war turns against Germany, his mental state deteriorates. He experiences facial numbness, like a dead leg or a dead arm, a dead face, a physical manifestation of his moral deadening. At the December concert, he hallucinates the audience as corpses. These moments suggest that despite his elaborate defenses, some part of him registers the horror of his actions. The third narrative voice belongs to Shmuel Zachariash, a Jewish prisoner forced to work in the Sonderkommando. His sections provide the moral center of the novel, offering testimony from the victim's perspective while exploring the impossible ethical dilemmas faced by those forced to participate in the machinery of death. Shmuel introduces himself as the saddest man in the lager and the oldest number, the longest surviving member of the squad. His longevity comes at a terrible price, complicity in processing the bodies of his fellow Jews. He describes the Sonderkommando as the saddest men in the history of the world, who are also infinitely disgusting, working with scissors, pliers, and mallets among the dead. What gives Shmuel's narrative its power is his unflinching self-awareness. He acknowledges his complicity while maintaining a core of resistance. He continues living for three reasons: to bear witness, possibly to exact vengeance, and most importantly, to save approximately one life per transport, always male youths whom they whisper to in Yiddish, German, and French, "You are 18 years old and you have a trade." Shmuel's sections explore the ethics of testimony itself. He and his fellow Sonderkommando members debate whether embellishing accounts is justified if it makes people more likely to believe the truth. They reject fabrications, insisting on accuracy even when the truth seems unbelievable. This commitment to truth-telling becomes a form of resistance against the Nazi attempt to erase evidence of their crimes. Throughout the novel, Amos meticulously examines the intricate mechanisms that enable ordinary people to participate in extraordinary evil. Language plays a crucial role in this process, serving as both a tool of deception and psychological distance. The Nazi regime created an elaborate lexicon of euphemisms to disguise atrocity: evacuation instead of murder, special treatment instead of gassing, pieces instead of corpses. This bureaucratic vocabulary created a parallel reality where mass murder could be discussed in terms of logistics and efficiency, allowing perpetrators to mentally separate themselves from the horror of their actions. This linguistic deception extends deeply into the perpetrator's self-conception. Dahl, the camp administrator, doesn't see himself as a mass murderer, but as a civil servant solving complex organizational problems. He obsesses over train schedules, personnel assignments, and resource allocation, using these administrative details as a shield against moral recognition. Thompson maintains his self-image as a decent person, despite his complicity, constructing elaborate justifications for his role in the system. Even minor characters like Fritherich Berkel, who advocates for better treatment of Jewish workers, frame their objections entirely in terms of efficiency and productivity rather than moral or humanitarian concerns. Their language reveals how deeply they've internalized the system's dehumanizing logic. The novel also explores how physical and psychological compartmentalization enables atrocity. The camp's architecture deliberately separates the killing areas from the administrative zones, creating artificial boundaries between different aspects of the genocide. The perpetrators develop sophisticated psychological defenses, drinking heavily to numb their consciousness, focusing obsessively on bureaucratic details, or maintaining rigid domestic routines to avoid confronting the reality of their actions. These coping mechanisms allow them to maintain a facade of normalcy while participating in mass murder. Perhaps most disturbingly, Amos shows how the victims themselves are forced to become unwilling cogs in the machinery of their own destruction. Schmuel describes Jews being compelled to participate in various aspects of the Nazi war effort, dyeing uniforms for the Eastern Front, working in munitions factories, or maintaining the camp's infrastructure. The Sonderkommando, Jewish prisoners forced to process the bodies of their fellow victims, represent the ultimate perversion of human dignity. This forced complicity represents one of the most cruel aspects of the Nazi system, not just killing people, but compelling them to participate in their own dehumanization. The psychological trauma of this forced participation creates another layer of suffering, as victims must grapple not only with their impending death, but with their involuntary role in the death of others. This machinery of dehumanization operates on multiple levels simultaneously, linguistic, psychological, physical, and social, creating a self-reinforcing system that transforms both perpetrators and victims while maintaining the illusion of normality and necessity. The novel's action unfolds against the backdrop of Germany's changing fortunes in World War II, with the devastating defeat at Stalingrad serving as both a military and psychological watershed moment for the characters. As news of German losses gradually filters through various channels, official communications, letters from the front, and whispered conversations, the previously unshakable confidence in final victory begins to crack, revealing deep fissures in the Nazi narrative of invincibility. Young Wolfram Prüfer, whose brother serves in Field Marshal Paulus's doomed Sixth Army, embodies this psychological transformation. Initially, he clings desperately to the official propaganda, repeating stories of tactical withdrawals and strategic regrouping. However, as the truth becomes impossible to deny, his facade crumbles. In a particularly poignant moment, he confesses that the encircled soldiers, freezing and starving in the Russian winter, have begun to see their suffering as divine retribution for their actions in Ukraine, specifically the mass shootings of civilians and the brutal treatment of the local population. This introduction of divine judgment into the narrative marks a crucial shift from triumphalism to the first stirrings of guilt and accountability. Paradoxically, as military defeats mount and resources become scarcer, the pace of killing in the camps accelerates rather than diminishes. Schmoll, the Jewish Sonderkommando worker, makes the chilling observation that, though the Germans cannot win against the Allies, they may still complete their war against Jews. This acceleration reveals the true ideological priority of the Nazi regime. The extermination of European Jewry took precedence over military victory or even tactical advantage. Trains that could have transported troops or supplies were instead used to transport victims to the death camps. The changing tide of war creates ripple effects throughout the camp's bureaucratic structure. Paul Dahl, the camp commandant, faces increasing scrutiny from Berlin officials who criticize his administrative methods and bookkeeping irregularities. The pressure to increase production at the Buna Verke chemical plant intensifies dramatically, even as raw materials become scarcer and skilled workers harder to replace. These mundane administrative challenges continue alongside the machinery of death, creating a surreal parallel reality where efficiency reports and production quotas exist alongside mass murder. The staff continues to file paperwork, attend meetings, and worry about career advancement, maintaining a bizarre facade of normality within the zone of interest. This period also sees increasing tension between different Nazi power centers as various officials compete for dwindling resources and influence. The industrial needs of the Reich clash with ideological imperatives, yet the extermination program maintains its priority status even as the military situation deteriorates on all fronts. The characters' responses to these changes reveal the deep psychological compartmentalization that allowed them to maintain their deadly work even as the world around them crumbled. While depicting the practical mechanics of genocide, Amos delves deep into the ideological underpinnings that made it possible. The novel presents Nazism not merely as a political movement, but as a quasi-religious worldview with its own internal logic, cosmic aspirations, and mythological foundations. This transformation of political ideology into a comprehensive belief system helped normalize the unthinkable among its adherents. The cosmic dimension becomes explicitly clear when Thompson visits his uncle Martin Bormann, who insists he investigate the cosmic ice theory being secretly researched in specialized SS institutes. Though scientifically absurd, the theory claims that the universe consists of eternal ice and that Aryan humans descended from godlike beings who arrived on ice meteors. This pseudo-scientific theory has profound political significance because Hitler believes it could provide a mandate from heaven for the Reich's expansionist ambitions. The episode powerfully illustrates how Nazi ideology combined modern bureaucratic efficiency with mystical, irrational elements, creating a worldview that was simultaneously futuristic and atavistic. Anti-Semitism appears throughout the novel not simply as racial prejudice, but as a comprehensive metaphysical worldview. At an elaborate dinner party, Dahl passionately cites Hitler's defense of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion as incontrovertible proof of a Jewish conspiracy controlling world finance and politics. The dinner guests discuss Jews not as a minority to be discriminated against, but as an existential cosmic threat requiring total elimination, a cancer in the body of humanity. This transformation of traditional anti-Semitism into an apocalyptic struggle between good and evil helped justify genocide in the minds of perpetrators. The novel meticulously explores how Nazi ideology perverted language, art, and culture to serve its ends. At the December concert, an Unterscharführer proudly recites German poetry, including works by Heinrich Heine, whose Jewish identity goes unrecognized by the audience. This cultural appropriation alongside genocide reveals the profound contradictions at the heart of the Nazi project. The regime simultaneously celebrated German high culture while destroying many of its creators, claimed scientific authority while embracing mysticism, and preached order while unleashing chaos. Through these episodes, Amos demonstrates how ideology can create an alternate reality so complete that its adherents become blind to its internal contradictions. The cosmic dimension of Nazi ideology extended to its vision of time itself. Characters frequently reference the Thousand-Year Reich and speak of their actions as part of a grand historical destiny. This millennial thinking helped remove normal moral constraints by placing current actions in service of an imagined glorious future. Even as the war turns against Germany, true believers cling to these cosmic justifications, showing how ideology can override reality itself. The novel builds toward Walpurgisnacht, April 30, a date layered with historical and symbolic significance. It marks Hannah's birthday, the future date of Hitler's suicide in 1945, though this occurs 2 years after the novel's action, and the night Paul Dahl has designated for Schmuel's execution. This convergence of dates creates a sense of apocalyptic reckoning with personal, historical, and metaphysical forces colliding in one fateful evening. The choice of Walpurgisnacht, traditionally associated with supernatural evil and the gathering of witches in German folklore, adds another layer of dark symbolism to the events. Dahl's execution plan represents the culmination of his psychological disintegration, which has been building throughout the novel. Once a bureaucratic functionary who masked his cruelty behind paperwork and procedures, he now reveals his complete moral collapse through this deeply personal act of sadism. He presents Shmuel with an impossible choice: murder Hannah or watch his own wife be killed. This ultimatum exemplifies the torturous choiceless choices that characterize the Holocaust, where victims were forced to make decisions between equally horrific outcomes. The scene draws particular power from its intimacy. Rather than the industrial-scale killing that defined the Holocaust, this is a face-to-face confrontation that strips away all pretense. Yet Shmuel does discover a third option, one that reclaims his moral agency even within the camp's dehumanizing system. By turning the weapon on himself and declaring, "Really, he wanted me to do this to you," he both exposes Dahl's true nature and asserts his own humanity. His suicide becomes an act of resistance, denying Dahl the power to force him into becoming a murderer. This moment crystallizes the novel's exploration of moral choice under extreme duress. The climactic scene weaves together the work's central themes: the impossible moral dilemmas faced by victims, the psychological deterioration of perpetrators, and the persistence of human dignity even in the most degrading circumstances. Shmuel's final declaration that, "With this final act, I prove my life is mine alone," represents both a personal triumph and a universal statement about human agency. His decision to bury his writings, ensuring that not all of me will die, transforms his death into an act of bearing witness. These hidden documents stand as both testimony and accusation, defying the Nazi regime's attempt to destroy not just lives, but all evidence of their crimes. Through Shmuel's final choices, the novel suggests that even in the darkest circumstances, possibilities for meaningful resistance remain. The novel's aftermath sections, set in the post-war period, unfold like a series of bitter epilogues, systematically dismantling any possibility of healing or redemption after such unprecedented horror. The fates of various perpetrators cascade through these pages with grim inevitability. Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, commits suicide by cyanide while fleeing Berlin in May 1945. Paul Dole, the camp commandant whose bureaucratic banality masked profound evil, is eventually hanged at Auschwitz, maintaining his delusional self-justifications until the end. The IG Farben executives, who had transformed chemistry into an instrument of mass murder, receive surprisingly light prison sentences, highlighting the inadequacy of justice in the face of industrial-scale atrocity. The emotional core of the aftermath centers on the final encounter between Thompson and Hannah in 1948 Berlin, amidst the ruins of the defeated Reich. Hannah's physical appearance has barely changed, marked only by two vertical furrows beside her nose, stress lines that hint at unspeakable experiences. Yet beneath this superficial continuity lies a fundamental transformation. Her very essence seems altered, as if the camps had rewritten her DNA of humanity. When Thompson, representing a desperate hope for normalcy and renewal, tentatively suggests they might have a future together, Hannah's response cuts through any possibility of conventional narrative resolution. Imagine how disgusting it would be if anything good came out of that place. This rejection of redemptive narrative becomes the philosophical cornerstone of Amos's vision. The Holocaust represents not merely a historical atrocity, but a fundamental rupture in human understanding, a black hole in our moral universe that defies both reason and representation. As Amos writes in his afterword, what makes that which happened so resistant to comprehension is that it remains beyond belief, even when all the facts are meticulously documented and understood. The novel steadfastly refuses the comfort of meaning or closure, suggesting instead that some experiences lie permanently beyond our capacity for understanding or integration into normal human experience. The aftermath sections systematically dismantle every possible avenue of consolation or meaning-making. Even the pursuit of justice through the Nuremberg trials and subsequent prosecutions appears inadequate, almost trivial, against the magnitude of the crime. The novel suggests that the very attempt to find meaning or redemption in such events is itself a form of moral failure, a retreat from the obligation to face the unthinkable without the cushion of narrative resolution or spiritual comfort. In his afterword, Amos engages directly with the profound challenges of representing the Holocaust in fiction, wrestling with questions that have haunted writers and philosophers for decades. He draws heavily on Primo Levi's seminal suggestion that perhaps we cannot, indeed must not, understand what happened, as understanding almost implies justification. The Nazi hatred exists outside man, containing non-human words and deeds that defy conventional moral and rational frameworks. This paradox, the simultaneous necessity and impossibility of comprehension, forms the central tension of the work. Yet the novel itself represents an urgent attempt to bear witness, to preserve memory against the erosive forces of time and denial. Schmuel's determination to bury his testimony so that not all of me will die reflects the ethical imperative of remembrance that drives survivors, witnesses, and their descendants. Through detailed accounts of daily life in the camp, from the mundane to the horrific, the novel suggests that while full understanding may be impossible, the obligation to remember remains absolute. This manifests not only in the preservation of facts, but in the attempt to capture the psychological and emotional reality of those who lived through it. This imperative extends beyond the historical event to its profound implications for human self-understanding. As Amos quotes philosopher J.M. Bernstein, the Nazi genocide is somehow central to our self-understanding. The novel meticulously explores how ordinary people, bureaucrats, officers, workers, became complicit in extraordinary evil, forcing readers to confront uncomfortable questions about their own potential for moral compromise. Through characters like Paul Dole and Thompson, Amos demonstrates how ideology, self-interest, and moral cowardice can transform seemingly normal individuals into participants in genocide. The Zone of Interest ultimately offers no consolation or catharsis, no comfortable resolution to ease the reader's conscience. Instead, it leaves readers with the crushing burden of knowledge and the perpetual obligation of remembrance. The novel's unflinching portrayal of both perpetrators and victims creates a documentary-like immediacy that makes forgetting impossible. In doing so, it fulfills literature's highest purpose, not to entertain or comfort, but to confront us with truths we might otherwise avoid, expanding our moral imagination and deepening our understanding of human possibility, both for evil and, perhaps, for resistance against it. The work also grapples with the responsibility of subsequent generations, suggesting that the duty to remember extends beyond those who directly experience the Holocaust. Through its careful attention to historical detail and psychological complexity, the novel becomes itself an act of remembrance, joining the essential body of work that ensures the Holocaust remains present in our collective consciousness and moral reasoning.